This season of Power Corrupts doesn't have ads, but we'd rather avoid being forced to engage in shady dealings to finance the show, so perhaps you can help us out in one of two ways. First, pre-order my new book, Corruptible: Who Gets Power and How It Changes Us, which comes out on November 9th. It's an exploration of the bizarre, fascinating ways in which humans relate to power that ranges from corrupt beehives to a ski lesson with a man who once ruled Iraq. Second, you can support the show by becoming a Patreon subscriber at patreon.com/powercorrupts. For just $3 a month, you'll get access to bonus content, as well as the possibility of a Zoom meet and greet with me and my producer, George. If you don't support the show, I'll be forced to bombard you with ads about socks and job recruitment schemes and mortgage websites, and nobody wants that. But seriously, thank you for listening and for your support. Have you ever had a fake ID? Known someone who had one? Either way, if you were going to make a fake ID for yourself, you'd probably want to go for something a bit inconspicuous. Pick a normal-sounding name. List your height correctly. Find a way to use your own photo, or at least find a picture of someone who looks remarkably like you. The last thing you'd want to do is to draw attention to yourself. These insights aren't exactly rocket science. Thankfully, for the investigators who try to catch those using fake identities, most of the fraudsters are decidedly not rocket scientists. That was certainly true of one case in Los Angeles, where a Filipino man was pulled over by police and asked to show his driver's license. When the officer looked at it, he thought the face seemed familiar. And that's because it was. It was a picture of Rodrigo Duterte, the president of the Philippines. Quote, "Good thing our officers are up to speed," the LAPD tweeted. "Nice try." The not-so-clever man was busted. Our stereotypical image of someone with a fake ID is an 18-year-old trying to buy booze at the local liquor store, perhaps like the awkward teenager McLovin from Superbad, or, for the Brits listening, Will from The Inbetweeners trying to wear a comically oversized business suit to pass as an adult. But the real story of fake IDs is far more interesting, and far more sinister. There are plenty of people around the world who use fake identities to commit crimes, to defraud people of vast sums of money, even to fly commercial airplanes without a valid license.
We'll be proceeding back, sir. We have lost engines. Sir, mayday, 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 Pakistan 8303.
The moment of disaster.
A passenger plane belonging to Pakistan International Airlines has crashed to the ground.
The Airbus ran into trouble on its approach to Karachi Airport after leaving Lahore. An investigation will seek to find out why.
In June of 2020, Pakistan's airline PIA had yet another plane crash, adding to an already dismal safety record. Finally, investigators decided to take the problem seriously, as they sought to get to the bottom of what caused a plane with no mechanical faults to be damaged and then to crash as a result of pilot error alone. And as they started doing rudimentary safety checks, they found something that was as disturbing as it was unbelievable. Of the country's 860 active pilots, 260 either had fake pilot licenses or had cheated on their pilot exams. In one instance, investigators found that a pilot who had crashed a plane had listed his exam date on a day that was a public holiday, a day in which there were no exams taking place, so he wasn't actually a qualified pilot. Aside from airplanes, in so much of society, an identity, a name, a face, a personal history defines our life chances. Our personal sense of identity defines who we are, but we also use documents, passports, labels for verification, proxies that simplify us down to what we are on paper. Most people are who they say they are, and they have the documents to back it up. But in today's episode, we're going to look at fakers and fraudsters who try to pass themselves, or a product, off as something it's not. We're going to meet a private investigator who tracks down some people who are supposed to be dead, and makes others who are very much alive disappear. And we're going to chat with one of the world's best winemakers, who took it upon himself to act like an FBI agent in his personal bid to bust the most audacious wine fraud in history. I'm Brian Kloss, and you're listening to Power Corrupts, the podcast where we shine a light on the hidden and often nefarious forces that shape our world. We're going to start with a simple question with a very complicated answer. How can you get away with faking your own death? It's a question that's been asked for a surprisingly long time. We tend to think of insurance fraudsters in the modern era, but there's a recorded case of someone faking their death much earlier, an English nun in the early 1300s. I spoke to Paul Dryborough of the UK National Archives and Helen Watt, a historian at the University of York, about a nun named Joan of Leeds, who had apparently had enough of life in the convent and decided to do something about it.
At some point, possibly late in 1317, early in 1318, she decides that she's had enough of life in the nunnery and, we assume, with help of accomplices in the house, basically fakes her own death because we think, the accusation is, she wants to live a life, a normal secular life with all of the pleasures that might bring. Going to the extent of faking a death suggests that she thought her ambition was hopeless, that she, unless she could get out, the only way she could do it was by kind of becoming a different person, ending Joan of Leeds the nun and becoming somebody else.
There are only a few entries about Joan of Leeds, but here's Helen reading an excerpt of one of them.
With the help of numerous of her accomplices, crafted a dummy in the likeness of her body in order to mislead the devoted faithful, and she had no shame in procuring its burial in a sacred space amongst the religious of that place.
It reads, as one historian put it, a bit like a Monty Python sketch. She made a dummy of herself, a fake nun, out of whatever materials were around, and it certainly wasn't high tech.
It's like somebody's put a blanket over a bedding of straw or something. Yeah. They've then bundled this up. They've pretended it's this poor departed girl. It's a completely preposterous story.
We don't really know what happened to Joan of Leeds after that. If she was discovered alive somewhere else, the records of someone finding her didn't survive. We just don't know. What we do know is that the sophistication required to fake your own death has drastically increased since the days of Joan of Leeds. To help us understand what it takes to fake your own death in the 21st century, I've tracked down the world's leading expert on that topic.
My name is Stephen Rombaum. I'm an investigator. I've been an investigator or intelligence gatherer of one kind or another for going on my 40th year now. I'm director of a company called Pelorium, which is a licensed investigative agency. And we work primarily missing persons cases, sophisticated financial frauds, and fake deaths, homicides, homicides for hire, things like that.
So tell me roughly how many fake deaths you've investigated over your career.
Well, the industry is slowing down, but I think I'm probably up to 750 or 800.
Wow. And I know that you can't talk about all the specifics of the various cases, but are there trends? I mean, what is sort of the stereotypical standard run-of-the-mill fake death? What is sort of like the motivation behind it and the sort of most common way of carrying it out?
Well, I mean, the stereotypical fake death is someone who puts his clothes next to a volcano and then disappears, or parks his car on a bridge with a suicide note and attempts to lead you to believe that he's jumped off the bridge. These are all actual cases. Or goes to a Mexican resort and folds his clothes on the beach and supposedly goes for a swim, and 2 days later his clothes are discovered on the beach and he hasn't been in his hotel room for 2 days, and the assumption that you're supposed to make is that he swum out and drowned and so on and so forth. Those are the stereotypical fake deaths. Some people actually don't even go to that type of trouble. They walk away and they let you come to that assumption on your own because you have the person hasn't been seen in a number of months. However, these days it's a lot more sophisticated. There are organized crime groups involved. And it has to be more sophisticated because it's harder and harder to disappear.
What are the motivations? Like when you've caught people, what are they trying to escape from? Is it mostly insurance fraud or is that a myth?
There's a lot of insurance fraud and other financial fraud. I mean, you don't have to necessarily take out a life insurance policy and fake your death. You can be a fraudster and scam or borrow a lot of money and then disappear when it's repayment time. It can be something financially sophisticated, or it can be something personally very mundane. It could be you're tired of your life, you want to hit the reboot button. And a lot of people feel that they have to completely sever all ties with their past to do that. And by the way, sometimes they do, because they have a wife, they have kids, they have a crappy job. I will tell you, in those circumstances, what's both funny and sad is when you find them, they have a new wife, new kids, and a new crappy job. So they might as well have stayed at home.
Stephen's work is pretty unusual. He's often trying to prove that people who claim to be dead are, in fact, alive. Some of the time, his clients are insurance companies who have a suspicion that a life insurance claim shouldn't be paid out because a fraud has been committed. But other times, the clients are just grieving people, clinging on to a little sliver of hope.
Some of these people are pretty sad. It's true. The individuals that come to me really don't want this person to be dead. They say, I saw my brother who I thought died 20 years ago. I got a glimpse of him. That's an actual case. Or I know my husband is alive and he's hiding for some reason. My son went away and I heard he died at this location and they sent me papers, but I think he was just angry at me, you know, some old woman living alone. Sometimes it's really, really sad.
I asked Stephen what his batting average was, so to speak. How often is he able to prove that a supposedly dead person is alive?
If it's an insurance carrier, by the time the case gets to me, by the time it percolates through the claims examiners who are, they're psychic, they are able to pull out a file out of 100 other files and determine this person faked their death. They're able to see the red flags. They're able to almost instinctively understand things. If I get one of those cases, I'm going to work it very, very hard because chances are this person has faked their death. The cases that I get from private people, maybe 10% of them, the people are still alive.
One of the weirdest aspects of the death faking industry, and it is an industry, believe it or not, is how it can range from the moronically simple to the diabolically innovative.
For example, you can go to Nigeria or the Philippines or a couple other places, and you can get what's referred to these days as a death kit. You can get a birth certificate, you can get identity documents, you can get a national ID number, you can get all of that, and then you can get a funeral, a death certificate, all the things that you need to do to die. I mean, you can be both the beneficiary and the dead person if you want. You can take out a whole new identity, kill yourself off, and then claim the insurance company payoff if you want.
Even though the death kits sold in places like the Philippines guarantee that you'll get some of the necessary documentation that comes with being dead, what's much harder is developing the persona of someone who is alive. And that's because our identities leave traces that we don't often think about. And those traces don't exist when you try to establish a new identity after faking your own death.
Those are, thank goodness, pretty easy to bust. They're easy to bust because the identity is what's referred to in the investigative community as a mile wide, but an inch deep. This is a person with no background. His face never appeared in a school yearbook. If you go to his neighbors, they've never seen him. There's no prior address. And I'm going to stop there because there's other things I don't want to talk about that we would look for. But it's pretty easy to show that this is a manufactured identity, a synthetic identity. So that's the lowest level.
If it's your first time faking your death and you're working on your own, odds are that you'll make a pretty major mistake. The kind of mistake that makes Stephen's job easy. But sometimes Stephen encounters much more professional operations, in which entire teams of people, including cartels, are involved in making someone appear to be dead.
When you get to sophisticated organized crime, you have all kinds of backup activity. For example, I did a case a number of years ago in Piedras Negras, Mexico, where there was an individual, the previously mentioned guy with the not satisfying life. He had six kids. He was working as an automobile mechanic in California. His second cousin was kind of a tricky young woman who lured him into a scheme. They went down to Mexico together. They met with some of her associates who were cartel people, organized crime people in Mexico.
And when these kinds of people get involved in faking a death, they don't mess around. It gets grisly quickly.
They put him in a house, took his wallet, found a drunk that looked, in terms of height and weight and other superficial things, a lot like him. Shot the guy in the face five times to disfigure him. Stuck the guy's wallet in the murdered man's pocket. Dumped it on the loading dock of a hospital. The hospital people brought the person in, of course, pronounced him dead. Sent the body over to the coroner because it was death by violence. And the coroner was part of the deal. He took the live guy's fingerprints and attested that these fingerprints came from the corpse and that the corpse was identified as the insured person. The beneficiary was, of course, the young 22-year-old female cousin who was working with organized crime.
Thankfully, Stephen is a top-notch investigator, so he was able to crack even this case and solve the murder, complete with speaking to a man from beyond the grave.
We were able to bust this case for a number of reasons. And I actually had one of the funniest interviews of my entire career with this guy. I tracked him down, and I met with him in his sister's restaurant, and we were, of course, filming the whole thing. I started asking him questions, and at a certain point during the interview, he got very obnoxious. I blurted out to him, I said, listen, cut the crap. Are you alive or dead? And he's, no, I'm alive. I'm alive. You can see I'm alive. Very, very funny interview.
In Stephen's line of work, you have to have a very dark sense of humor. And there are plenty of opportunities to laugh because people do some very stupid things when they're trying to fake their own deaths.
Fake deaths always, thank goodness, involve somewhere along the line an idiot. First of all, let me tell you, the secret to my success is the fact that most of the people that I go after are about as far as you can get from Professor Moriarty. They are people who are lazy or inefficient or assume that nobody's going to cross a national boundary. They make a number of assumptions. The other secret to my success is if you are an investigator and you are diligent enough, you are dogged enough, you will bust 99.999% of all cases. Cold cases, hot cases, new cases, old cases, cases of all kinds.
Stephen also has a built-in advantage when it comes to investigating fake deaths. Call it the detective's dividend, if you will.
One of the reasons why skilled investigators are so successful is because you may go out and fake your death or commit a fraud or do something else silly, And you have the experience of doing it once. I have the experience of investigating it about 400 times. I know what the red flags are. I know what to look for. You just can't beat the 1,000-to-1 experience.
And presumably they have to be perfect and you have to get lucky once.
That's exactly correct. I can make 1,000 mistakes doing my investigation of your fraud. If you make one, you're toast.
And as Stephen has found, there are many, many opportunities for fraudsters in his crosshairs to make mistakes.
Disappearing is a full-time job. You can't ever see anybody that you knew before. You have to stay away from your family. You have to change your lifestyle. You have to have all of the necessary documents required to live a life in today's world. Driver's license, social security number, bank account, passport, all of these things have to be basically pre-planned. A lot of people that we catch, they fake their death and they realize this stuff later and they're royally screwed.
Investigating fake deaths is one of those jobs that gives us a bizarre, unexpected insight into how our world has changed over time, both in terms of our everyday existence and in terms of the systems that surround us. Few of us have ever seriously contemplated faking our own deaths. But by getting a glimpse into Stephen's funhouse mirror of a world, we get a reflection of how our own societies have shifted. And nowhere is that more obvious than when Stephen talks about how difficult it is to fake your own death in the 21st century.
Think about what you need to lead a normal life. You need an identification document, a state ID or a driver's license, typically a driver's license. And it has to be real. Even the lowest level private investigator can verify a driver's license. And the photo can't have changed because it's easy to verify a photo. You've got to have a social security number. If you don't have a social security number, you can't fly, for example. You've got to have bank accounts. You've got to have credit cards. And they can't be bank accounts and credit cards and driver's license and social security number that magically appeared 2 weeks ago, because that's very easily determined. You've got to have a history. And then, thanks to social networking, you've got to have some type of internet presence if you are a certain age. You can't have a Facebook page that appeared a week ago. In the physical world, as the kids say, IRL, in real life, you've got to have prior addresses. Okay, you live at 123 Main Street now, but you've only been here for a year. Where'd you live a year ago? You can't just magically appear fully formed. You've got to have had a life. And it's a problem. If you're a professional with resources and other people to help you, you might be able to do it. But there's a lot of mistakes to be made. And then you've got to make sure that your prior persona is completely dead and buried. I mean, there's a lot that obviously, you know, admittedly, I'm not telling you about what documents trip people up and what tricks investigators use to bust a false identity or determine what identity someone who's faking their death has taken. But I will tell you that there's always a point when those two identities touch, and a good investigator will find that.
I took Stephen's point. Disappearing in the 1950s would have been 1,000 times easier. Without a digital footprint, local investigators would be reliant on paper in files and archives, and paper documents can be forged much more easily. Move across state or national boundaries, and you're probably home free. It seems much more doable. But still, having spent a lot of time in remote parts of developing world countries where the state is largely absent from daily life, I figured I could at least make a decent attempt if I really needed to. What strikes me as a person who's spent very, very little time thinking about faking my own death is I would probably, you know, go somewhere like Thailand, you know, disappear with a cash-based life in, you know, some hut in the middle of nowhere. I mean,
okay. So you're a 35-year-old American white guy and you want to live in a hut in Thailand. Well, how would you get to Thailand? What money would you use to rent that hut? How would you eat? How would you survive? If you get sick, who are you and how are you getting health care? How do you get there? Well, you're not going to swim. You're not going to be a pirate and steal a boat. You have to fly there. So under what name do you fly there? Do you fly under your own name? Okay, then you have to fake your death in Thailand. Do you have a body? Do you have a scenario where there can be no body? And then what identity do you take? What do you do to get legal residency? Do you have a visa that's going to last longer than 6 months in Thailand? Do you marry some Thai woman and apply for citizenship? Thai police are very tough. I have worked with the Thai police. I can tell you if they catch you, they will give you a combat booted foot in the behind and shove you onto a plane bound for America. So how do you live there legally without being caught, without being deported? What you don't want to do, Brian, is you don't want to have a life that's worse than the life that you left behind. I mean, what's the point of that? If you're going from a crappy life to an even crappier life, you might as well stay in your moderately crappy life.
I've got a very nice life, and getting a boot in my behind, as Stephen so poetically put it, doesn't sound very appealing to me. So I'm not planning to try to disappear anytime soon. And again, I saw that Stephen had a point. Getting away with faking your own death in 2021 would be hard, at least if someone was looking for you. But for a lot of these people, they're probably not aware that someone is looking for them. Which is why I had to ask Stephen about what happens when he finally finds someone who is supposed to be dead.
I will tell you, nothing beats an ambush interview. A couple of times I've confronted people, and yeah, sometimes you have to sit outside the house. Some people are more careful than others. They go into a location and they basically hide out for a few months. You don't give them a chance to think. You don't give them a chance to prepare. You don't give them a chance to run. You don't give them a chance to call their third cousin who's a big-time lawyer. You say, Bob, why'd you do it? And the people are typically, you know, you hear the expression, deer in the headlights. They are more than deer in the headlights. They're deer whose head have already been mounted. You've got them. It's the kill. Once you walk up to a dead guy or a dead woman, and it's more and more women these days, by the way, when you walk up to this person and you call them by their true name and they know that they're busted, that's it. They're finished. And sometimes they just stand there semi-comatose for a minute or two.
As I was speaking to Stephen, a thought occurred to me. If he's caught nearly 1,000 people who have faked their deaths the wrong way, surely that must give him unique insights into how to fake his own death the right way.
Do you think that you could fake your own death at this stage?
Absolutely. I will tell you, I ran my own private witness protection program for a number of years, and I have renamed and relocated the people that I call my children because I got to give them their names and their dates of birth and everything. There have been 10 instances in my life where I have taken people who, for legitimate reasons, needed to disappear, and I helped them disappear. And I will tell you that of those 10, 9 of them have been living their entire lives. I haven't done this for 20 some odd years, but of those 10, 9 of them are still living their lives totally undercover. They all contact me once a year, once every 2 years, just to let me know how they're doing.
The 10th person that Stephen made disappear was a criminal who made some very dangerous enemies. But he was eventually able to reappear because the person who was threatening him died and the problem went away.
The joke is he was a big criminal and now he's a major real estate agent in the Carolinas, so he's an even bigger criminal.
Thank you. One of the insights that Stephen's work teaches us about fakers and fraudsters is that the system around them matters enormously. Americans, for example, have a harder time faking their death than, say, someone living in Somalia, partly because investigators are more likely to come looking for you in the US, but mostly because the regimented systems that define our lives are much more rigid in countries with strong governments. When there's a weak oversight system, or a non-existent one, well, that's like rolling out the red carpet for the fraudsters. And when you roll out red carpets, you need something to drink after you walk down one. And that something is quite often high-end, rare wine.
In the big money world of fine and rare wine, there's one name that's spoken with awe. Rudy Kerniawan.
A few months ago, I spoke to two people who helped crack the case of the greatest wine fraudster of all time.
My name is Peter Hellman.
Peter is a journalist, writer, and author of the book In Vino Duplicitas.
My name is Laurent Ponceau. I am a winemaker in Burgundy.
Laurent's wine, Domaine Ponceau, is a highly sought-after wine that is well-known to wine connoisseurs who love to drink Burgundy.
I have a quite long experience as I was born above a cellar some years ago. I think that in my blood there is some wine.
And this story begins, somewhat improbably, in Indonesia, with a man who was born as Zhen Wang Huang, but soon began telling others that his name was Rudy Kerniawan. And even early on, there were signs that not everything about Rudy was above board.
Born in Jakarta, Indonesia, in 1976, came to America, to California, to go to college. He came probably in 1993, went to a California State College, got an accounting degree, did very well. He was apparently an A student, floated around a bit. He worked at a pro shop, a golf pro shop, for a while. At some point, a very expensive Japanese driver disappeared from the shop when he was on duty. And when the proprietor asked him about what happened to that driver, Rudy basically said, "I don't know." When he left that day, he never returned.
When it comes to hobbies for rich people, golf wasn't the one that excited Rudy. Instead, he discovered his true passion during a fateful dinner several decades ago in San Francisco.
In about 1999, his father came from Indonesia for a visit, and it was his birthday, and so they had a birthday dinner for his father at a restaurant at Fisherman's Wharf in San Francisco. At the restaurant, Rudy, who at this point knew zero about wine, looked at the wine list. He ordered the most expensive wine on the list, which was an Opus 1, a so-called cult Cabernet Sauvignon from the Napa Valley. I'm guessing it was probably about a $250, $300 bottle of wine in 1979. And when he tasted it, it just seemed to unlock a previously inactive portion of his brain, a sensory portion. He just flipped out over it. It was just something that just knocked him back. He loved it. The next day, he began to seek out all the Opus One that he could find in the Los Angeles area. And he bought every bottle. And, you know, the harder it was to buy, the more people wanted to buy it.
For a while, though, Peter had never heard of Rudy Kerniawan. That is, until one day, while he was at the gym working out, when he got an intriguing phone call.
I got a call on April 25th, 2008, in the late afternoon, from a wine dealer. I had just been to the gym. I wasn't too happy to have to immediately take a shower and get dressed and go down to crew, but something in my journalist instinct told me I better do it.
The caller told Peter that something quite unusual was about to happen during a wine auction for some truly high rollers.
22 lots of very old vintages of Domaine Ponceau wines were going to be withdrawn from the auction at the demand of the fourth generation proprietor of Domaine Ponceau. And Ponceau was very, very sought after.
The wines were causing a stir partly because they had been offered for sale by a man who had been taking the wine world by storm, You guessed it, Rudy Carniolan. After developing his taste for wine so suddenly, Rudy didn't waste any time. He somehow tapped huge lines of capital and started buying and selling top dollar wines. Overnight, he became a viceroy of vino, a Bordeaux baron, a Cork kingpin, and he had a natural talent for it too.
There was a great French professor who once divided in terms of people's ability to taste wine. He said, compare it, think about a room full of people. They're all sipping wine, and then you have somebody go into the next room, and that person has in his or her hand a fine crystal wine glass. And that person takes a silver spoon and taps the crystalware. And then back in the other room, someone will say, oh, I heard a sound. What is that? A person with a better sense of what they're hearing would say, oh, I think somebody tapped a crystal glass. And a third person, who was really perceptive in audio matters, would say, yes, and that note was E flat. Well, Rudy knew E flats in the wine glass. He had, in effect, perfect pitch for wine. In any case, he just sprung full force out of nowhere and was suddenly buying and reselling extraordinarily expensive, extraordinarily rare wines to the tune of $30 million. He was possibly had become the greatest wine buyer and seller on the planet.
At the same time that Peter was leaving the gym, Laurent Ponceau was on his way to the auction after boarding a last-minute flight.
I got a message by email from a friend in New York that was about to buy some of my old wines in an auction. And he was asking a very strange question. Since when do you produce the Clos Saint-Denis? Clos Saint-Denis is one of the Grand Cru of Burgundy.
For those of you who are like me and don't drink high-end wines, which I imagine is most of you, a Grand Cru wine means that it's the best of the best. The email was asking Laurent, which year did he start producing the Clos Saint-Denis Grand Cru wine?
And I didn't answer to this question. I said, why are you asking? Because of the time zones, I waited some hours to have him on the phone. And he said, oh, there is an auction in New York in 2 days. And they are selling Clos Saint-Denis from Domaine Ponceau from the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. And the answer was, we started in 1982. So there is no way that these bottles could be real.
Laurent didn't have to channel his inner Sherlock Holmes, or perhaps more fittingly, his inner Arsène Lupin, to deduce that it was impossible for a wine from the 1940s or 1950s to be genuine if the wine it claimed to be only started being made in 1982. So, hoping to stop a fraud in progress, Laurent called the auction house and demanded the wine be withdrawn before some rich person got swindled.
After I called the auctioneer and after he said that he would withdraw the wines from the auction, I was not sure. I was feeling that it was a lie just to stop me talking. Then I decided to fly to New York.
These wine auctions were pretty strange events. A lot of money was sloshing around in finance, banking, politics, you name it. And some people decided that they could either show off their wealth or fashion themselves into a cultured aficionado if their cash was instead sloshing around a perfectly shaped wine glass.
This was a period when wine prices were going crazy, rare wine prices. The basic market was kind of stable, but at the upper stratospheric end, there were many, many wealthy people who were bidding for the rarest bottles. A lot of money had been made on Wall Street. There were too many, often young guys, who had too much money to spend. You know, once you'd bought a Maserati sports car, once you'd bought a condo overlooking the ocean in South Beach, once you'd bought the very fancy Rolex, what else are you going to buy? Well, old fine wine, particularly French wine, was really a tempting purchase because once you owned it, your friends would say, oh, what is it about that 1962 Latoche that makes it so valuable? Why do you like it so much? And it's a bit like buying esoteric art, you know, it makes you feel cultured. You bought something, anybody can buy a Maserati if they have the money, but not anybody can buy 62 Latash or appreciate it.
To buy truly rare wines, whether for genuine appreciation or as a cultural status symbol, you had to attend these auctions. And the auction organizer had figured out a strategy that was quite effective at boosting prices. Prices that could, believe it or not, go as high as $500,000 for the most coveted bottles.
He passed around bottles of very, very good wine and offered it to people sitting around who were waiting to bid. And of course, the more of these good wines that they sipped, the longer they were liable to hold their paddle up in the air, maybe longer than they anticipated holding it up. So everybody was pretty loose by the midpoint of this auction.
And then the shockwave that Peter had been promised finally arrived. The auctioneer stood up and said,
"At the request of the domain and with the agreement of the consignor, I'm withdrawing the next 22 lots of Domaine Ponceau wines." At this point, there was a roar of dismay from the bidders out there. One of them yelled out, "F*** you!" You never would normally hear that in a British auction. Everybody would faint if they ever heard language like that.
Peter's journalistic instincts kicked in. He figured that there had to be an interesting backstory to what had just happened. So he tried to find the man who had tried to sell the wines that had just been withdrawn.
I said, "Rudy Kernelwan, is he here?" And Robert Bohr said, "Yeah, he's that little guy over in the corner." And I looked over there, and there was a beautifully dressed, very young fellow. And so I walked over to him. Now, as a journalist, I am not an undercover type. I don't do well masquerading as somebody else. I just have to be me. But in this case, I decided I'm going to let Rudy think I'm a collector. So I went over to him and I said, "Hey, Rudy." And he looked at me and I see he's trying to think, where do I know this guy from? Of course, he doesn't know me because we've never met. And I said, "Rudy, so what happened with those 22 lots of Domaine Ponceau wines?" I see him thinking, you know, what he's going to say to me. And finally he said, "Well, you know, we try our best, but it's Burgundy and shit happens."
Laurent was also intrigued by the mystery of Rudy Kernelwan, this man who had seemingly come out of nowhere with wines that couldn't exist.
I wanted to know where the wines were coming from, who was the owner of the wines. All these things together makes me very quickly decide to investigate.
So he arranged to have lunch with Rudy and an associate to ask them about the fake wine and to try to figure out who had swindled Rudy into buying fraudulent bottles in the first place.
At that moment, I was thinking that this guy was a victim of someone that sold him wine. He noticed they were fake and he wanted to resell it. That was my opinion at that moment. And at that moment, I say, okay, after we said, "Hello, are you, blah, blah," have a first drink. I said, "Okay, tell me now, where the wines are coming from? Where did you buy these wines?" And so no answer from Kernelwan, no answer from Capon. They were mumbling and saying things, "Oh, we buy so many bottles, we don't know, we don't remember." At that second, I knew that they were not nice people, I would say. I knew they were lying. Because when you have nearly 100 bottles of old Ponceau, this is the Graal. It's so difficult to find. It's easy to find Romane Conti old, but it's very difficult to find the real old bottles of Ponceau. So when you have it, you know where it comes from.
Laurent figured that something fishy was going on, so he decided to persist in getting to the bottom of what Rudy Kernelwan was up to. So he flew out to where Rudy lived to have another chat.
I invited him to dinner in Los Angeles, and during this dinner, he gave me the name by email, but he gave me two phone numbers, and when I noticed that the phone numbers were not reaching anyone, when I noticed that the name he gave me was like John Smith in Indonesia, it means everybody, half of the population is named like this, so I knew that he was really playing a very strange game. So this is when I decided to investigate.
When Laurent Ponceau, grand winemaker of Burgundy, decides to investigate, he really decides to investigate.
It took time before I decided to really act as a as an investigator, an FBI guy. And I did, like you can imagine, and like you see in the movies, I rented the car. I was staying in front of his house with dark glasses, and I was waiting till he goes out. I did that several times, and I got some evidences. Then I went to Asia to investigate, to know where this guy was born, where he was living. He was also lying on this family, which was supposed to be rich, and so on. Then I followed also the fake bottles in Hong Kong, in Singapore, in Los Angeles, in New York. So it took me quite a while, and after 2 years, I have been asked by the real FBI agent and the prosecutor of New York if I could join them because they wanted themselves to investigate. So 2 years I did it by myself, and the next 2 years we were a team. Well, actually the FBI guys went also further, they did their own job, and we had meetings, and I gave them all my evidences that finally brought them to arrest Rudy Kirnawan 3 years later.
When the investigators closed in and pounced, what they uncovered was a truly monumental fraud.
Rudy Kirnawan, from that time in 1999, possibly 2000, when he tasted his first Opus One, over the next 8 years, he sold, this is hard to believe, but this is the figure that the government came up with, $30 million worth of wines to wealthy collectors. Fake wines.
And this is where the story diverges from just an intriguing tale of rare wines and high flyers getting hoodwinked into something much more profound about how a given industry can make itself vulnerable to fraud. Systems matter. And the systems around high-end wine were absolutely, excuse the pun, ripe for a fraudster.
When you look at a bottle of, let's say, $5,000 Chateau Petrus, and you set it next to a bottle of Two Buck Chuck, the wine that came out of Trader Joe's, the bottle is the same. There's no difference in cost between the physical bottle of those two wines. Whether it's, you know, a dollar or something close to a dollar, that's it. The label itself, of course, printing may be more or less expensive, the paper, the embossing, and so on, but the label doesn't cost that much. None of the packaging, even the cork, a very fine long cork, might cost a dollar, dollar and a half.
So you could take a cheap old bottle and make it look like an expensive old bottle, pretty easily. But then, on top of that, there was the fact that old wines are often spoiled, so collectors have lower expectations despite the high prices.
When you are a wine connoisseur and when you are quite wealthy and you want to buy the rarest bottle existing on the planet, old for sure, you know that it is a lottery. You know that because of the cork, the wine has could have been exposed to oxygen, too much oxygen, so be oxidized, we say dead. And when you have bottles, let's say from 1934, for example, you have 70% chances that the wine is affected and only 30% chances that the wine is still good. And then you have only 10% chances that the wine is outstanding. That's it. So people which are a little knowledgeable on wine, they know that. So they still buy it for $20,000 a bottle, knowing that maybe they will not get what they expect. And this guy was playing on it.
Plus, it was often a while before the collectors even found out that the wine wasn't what they expected.
The product, the treasure, if you will, is locked inside the bottle. It's not like buying a Rolex and saying, oh, I wonder if this Rolex is authentic. I'm going to take it into my watch dealer. And you take it into the watch dealer, he pops the back off and takes a look at the mechanism and says, yes, it's real, or no, it's not. With wine, the only way you ultimately can maybe know if the wine is authentic is if you pull the cork and drink it. So wine is a very good candidate for forgery and fakery. You can't get it out until you pull the cork, and once you pull the cork, you ruin the value of the bottle.
And then, perhaps the most valuable lesson of all that Rudy Kirnawan understood instinctively. If you're going to swindle someone, make them happy while you screw them over. And to accomplish that goal, Rudy would start with genuinely old wines, but bad ones, and give them quite a makeover.
When the bottles arrived at his house in Arcadia, California, he would say, take a bottle of, well, in this case, let's say it was 1959, Clos Andenis. He would take a bottle of commercial grade 1959 wine. He would pour half the bottle out, and then he would pour in half a bottle of good quality California Pinot Noir, possibly Oregon Pinot Noir. Fairly typical, and it resembled the real thing from Burgundy. And he would kind of mix and blend and experiment. And eventually, he would get a mix of the old wine and the new wine, the old Burgundian wine, the new California wine. If you tasted that wine, if you knew Burgundy, you would say, wow, this wine has the funk of old Burgundy. I know it's 1959. I know this is 50-year-old wine or 60-year-old wine. And it's got that kind of barnyard quality that old Burgundy has. But underneath it is this beautiful, youthful Pinot Noir fruit. Wow, it's amazing that after 60 years, it's preserved. And of course, you were right on both counts. You were tasting old Burgundy with barnyard funk, and you were tasting young California Pinot Noir, the same grape, which had this youthful character.
This was a masterclass in taking advantage of soft systems to deceive people who want to believe that what they're buying is truly something special, something worth the absurd price tag hanging from the neck of the bottle. But could this happen again? Laurent, for his part, is now confident that the vulnerability Rudy exposed has largely been solved.
And we are living in the 21st century today. We have a lot of means, a lot of tools that can help us to do that. And today, my bottles, for example, are protected with five different tools, I would say. So it would be too difficult for any crook to spend money to fake my bottles. It's impossible. So we have today a lot of protection.
And if those five methods ever fail, he could always call Stephen Rombaum, who, I'm sure, would be all too happy to assist with Laurent's next FBI-style stakeout. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode or learned something new, please rate and review the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen. And if you're feeling really generous, tell your friends about the show, post about it on social media, or support the show directly by pre-ordering my new book, Corruptible: Who Gets Power and How It Changes Us, or by becoming a Patreon subscriber at patreon.com/powercorrupts. In the next episode, Hitman for Hire, we're going to look at how people try to use the dark web to hire contract killers and explore the strange argument that the online hitman industry actually keeps people safe. Don't miss it. This episode was written and narrated by me, Brian Kloss. The executive producer was George McDonough, who also did the sound editing. Music by Scott Holmes. Special thanks to Nazanin Ferdusi, who helped research this episode. Goodbye for now.